I'm actually going to start with the last verse of Judges, which is the book before, so I'm going to turn a page. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech. Thanks. His wife's name Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. It sounds like it's working.
Yeah, there it is.
They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. And they, after they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died. And Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where they had been living and set on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law,
"Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband."
Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud and said to her,
"We will go back with you to your people."
But Naomi said,
"Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband, even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons. Would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me."
At this they wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. Naomi said,
"Look, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her."
But Ruth replied,
"Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me."
When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, "Can this be Naomi?" She told them,
"Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me."
So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. So I've called it God Working Behind the Scenes, and we're looking at Ruth 1, which you probably still got open. So I'll start with an introduction. So the story of Ruth is set at the time of the Judges. It follows Judges, probably around 1300 BC, and we're not sure who wrote it. It's a well-known book of the Bible, probably due to its popularity as a good story to tell younger children. On the surface, it seems like a story with its tragedies, but where the main characters who are introduced to sort of live happily ever after. And this tragedy and later blessing that we see is what the story is about. But when we look at it in more detail, we find some interesting things about about what God's like, and we're going to do that tonight and over the next 4 weeks. I'm just going to see how God works in different situations and see some really good examples of trust and faith in God. So this theme of faithfulness and kindness, it runs through the whole book, and I hope we'll see that as we go through. I want to introduce you to a word that's used quite a few times in the original language. It's hesed, and we don't have a one-word equivalent, so it's translated as different things as we read through, but it's basically, it refers to a covenantal loyalty, faithfulness, kindness, goodness, mercy, love, and compassion. So all those words into one, and that's what we're talking about. And it can be shown by God to people, or it can be shown sort of from one person to another as sort of a reflection of God's own hesed to us. And we see examples of both these types tonight and through the book. It's a voluntary but an essential action. It's something that its recipient needs to avoid something that's unpleasant. The person who performs it is the more powerful party in the relationship, and we'll see that as we go through. So the first verse of the chapter and the last verse of Judges tell us what we need to know to understand the rest of the chapter and the rest of the book. Judges tells us, in those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So it gives us the time when the story happened, but more importantly, it tells us the state of God's people at that time, and it wasn't a good state. So as we start Ruth, should we be surprised when we read that the land was in famine? It's interesting to note that Bethlehem, where the story is set, actually means house of bread. So as we see famine in a place that's named for its usually plentiful food, it seems to point to God's judgment, and that's kind of built on as we look through. So we're probably familiar with Israel's general pattern of behaviour throughout the Old Testament. We see them enjoying times of blessing as they obey God and come close to him. We unfortunately see them frequently moving away, going to other things, and then we see judgment. And then when we see that judgment and they say they've been judged, they tend to go back to God. And we see that cycle go around and around quite a few times throughout the Old Testament. So at this point, it looks like God's people are going through a time of judgment. So based on the past, the sensible thing to do would be to turn back to God in repentance at this point. So that's a very quick introduction. Okay, so we saw as we read it that this chapter takes a sort of narrative, and I've identified three different scenes which we're going to look at in turn. So firstly, this scene is set looking at verses 1 to 5. We get introduced to this family, one man and his family, who try to sort things out for themselves. Instead of turning back to God, the man was Elimelech and his wife Naomi. Their sons were Mahlon and Chilion. The family were Ephrathites, and Ephratah was the name given to the bigger area which Bethlehem was found in. And as Bethlehem meant house of bread, Ephratah means fruitful. So we get to see again that a land that's usually fruitful and doesn't let the people down has let them down, and so pointing to God's judgment again. And the fact that we're told that the Ephrathites should ring bells later in the story as we meet Boaz. And it's good to look at Hebrew name meanings because they usually mean something. So firstly, we've got Elimelech. His name meant my God and is king, which is a bit ironic when he makes this decision to leave Bethlehem, go to Moab and try and sort his problems out for himself. He's sort of forgetting, my God is king. We have Naomi, which means pleasant, which again is sort of ironic, as towards the end of the chapter, which we'll look at, she identifies that her life isn't very pleasant throughout this chapter. Then we have Mahlon and Chilion, which mean sickness and annihilation, which is quite fitting here, as by the end of verse 5, they are dead. So helpful to see that. The question to ask at this point is, why did Elimelech take his family to Moab? Although we're not told much about the family, we can presume that, as everyone was doing, he and his family were doing what was right in their own eyes. Therefore, when the famine came, he didn't turn back to God. They decided to sort things out. They went to Moab. Moab was a land to the east of the Jordan, Judah's closest neighbour at the east, but far enough away, obviously, to be not suffering from famine at that time. The people of Moab were descended from Lot and his elder daughter. And at various times through the Old Testament, we see Moab and Israel and or Judah sort of in conflict. The ESV translation uses the word sojourn to describe how Elimelech saw his time spent in Moab. Now, this word refers to a time spent away with the intention of returning. And we see as we read through that God's plan is obviously different for Elimelech at this point. So we see that Israel as a whole is under judgment, and now we see that a family in particular is under God's judgment. Firstly, Elimelech dies, leaving Naomi and her two sons. It might be that Elimelech was quite old, but as we saw, he did intend to return. It's more likely that God had his hand in this. He was judging them for not doing what he would expect. Moving on, we see that Mahlon and Chilion marry Moabite women, but after 10 years, they die too, and they don't leave any children. So we see God's hand here too, although Mahlon and Chilion might not have had a say in moving away from Bethlehem. They were probably to blame responsible for finding themselves wives in Moab. And we see that in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 1 to 4, Israelites are forbidden from intermarrying with people of inhabitants of the Promised Land. And although Moabites aren't specifically mentioned here, we see in Deuteronomy 23, verses 3 to 6, that Moabites are told they can't enter the assembly of the Lord due to past tensions. So, and that's because of when relationships had happened in the past. We read about in Numbers 25, 1 to 5, it caused the Israelites to turn away from God, turn to foreign gods, and therefore be judged as a result of that. So, from all that, we can infer that marrying a Moabite woman wasn't a good idea. It was going against God's law. And we can presume that Mahlon and Chilion and Naomi would have known that too. But again, they were taking things into their own hands. They were trying to get themselves sons so they could carry on their family. But we see this doesn't happen. 10 years would be enough time, definitely, to produce offspring. And yet God prevents this. And then Mahlon and Chilion die too, probably at a relatively young age. So we see further judgment again. So quite a bleak opening to the story, and we see a faithful side of God that we perhaps don't think about enough or don't want to think about. We see God being faithful to all of his promises. Sometimes we only think about the positive things God promises, but we forget that every time God promises blessing to his people, he also promises curse for when those people get the thing wrong. Thankfully, things begin to change. So the second sort of section of this is verses 6 to 18, and we read about Naomi journeying back to Bethlehem. So The next section is the biggest section of the chapter, and it contains quite a lot of dialogue between Naomi and her daughters-in-law. Firstly, before we look at that, we see the reason that Naomi decided to go back to Bethlehem. In verse 6, we see that Naomi hears that the Lord has provided for her people. He's given them food, so the famine's over. And some have suggested that there might have been famine now in Moab, which may have caused the sons to die. So it seems the obvious thing to do to return to Bethlehem, where there is now food. The fact that as soon as Naomi hears about the food in Bethlehem and sets off shows that Naomi still does believe in God and trust him. And the narrative suggests that she knows that the food in Bethlehem is from God. It's not just because the earth is yielding again. It's from God. So we see a glimmer of hope in that God's blessing his people again. And we see that Naomi has some trust in God and is willing to return home. Another question I thought that we might ask at this point is, why do Naomi's daughters-in-law go with her? And we can have a look and see that at this point, Ruth and Orpah had been with her at least 10 years, probably a bit longer. And therefore, the bonds that they had with Naomi were probably quite strong. And as Naomi was their elder, their mother-in-law, they would have submitted to what she was doing. And when she decided to go, they'd have just seen it as their duty to go back with Naomi. And we see this bond in verse 9, where Naomi kisses them and they cry. It's clear that it's not easy for any of them at this point to even think about parting, going their different ways. It might be the case that they didn't really talk about it before they went. They just followed on. It might be the case that they had talked about it, said they'd go, but then Naomi changed her mind, and that sparks the dialogue that follows. So we see that Naomi has a speech now, for want of a better thing. So we get a glimpse of how she's feeling. We've seen what's happened. It's covered quite a space of time. We haven't really heard how anyone's feeling. And we see some of Naomi's attitude towards God. In verse 8, seemingly out of the blue, Naomi begins her argument for why Ruth and Orpah should return back to Moab. And she goes at it from a number of angles to be as persuasive as possible. So she tells them first to return because she isn't going to have any more sons for them for three reasons. She doesn't have a husband. Even if she did, she's probably too old to have children. And even if she could have children, it would be at least sort of 15 to 20 years before those sons were grown up and could marry these two daughters-in-law, by which time they might be too old. So quite a good argument there. Naomi's second argument relates to the judgment that she's had from God and her whole family has faced. She tells Ruth and Orpah that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me, she says, and a phrase that she repeats later on as well. She explains that this is why her husband's died, this is why her sons have died, this is why her sons hadn't produced or provided any children before they did die, and therefore they'd be much better off returning home to their families. And that's shown where she says, may the Lord deal kindly with you in verse 8, and she says, the Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of your husband. And that's in verse 9. So she implies that the opposite to, if they do the opposite of that, things aren't going to go well. And so these arguments sound quite logical if you looked at it from their perspective as things stand. If they stick together, they all go back to Bethlehem, they're going to live as poor widows living on other people's charity until they die. But again, as we saw with Naomi's decision to return, we see some of Naomi's beliefs about God here. Firstly, we see that she recognised that this judgment, what's happened to her family, is from God. And we'll look at that in the next section. And second, we see that Naomi knows God and she knows what he's like. I introduced you to the word hesed before the song. And if anyone can remember all the words I said after, I'll give you a prize. And this is where we see the word first used. Naomi knows that God can and will show this hesed, or kindness, to Ruth and Orpah as a result of the same hesed that they have shown to Naomi and her now dead family. We see God showing hesed to people here, and we see that these two daughters-in-law have actually shown this hesed to Naomi. And that shows that as Naomi was the recipient of it here from these two daughters-in-law, that they were sort of in the better position. They were the stronger people at this time. So despite Ruth and Orpah initially refusing to return, by the end of Naomi's argument, Orpah has been persuaded. She's heard Naomi's logical reasoning and realised that she does have more chance of survival if she returns to her old ways, her country. It's worth mentioning at this point that the narrator never talks in a negative way about Orpah, but, and to the reader, to us, it looks like Orpah might have made the sensible decision here. We don't hear about her again, but her return does make Ruth's choice to stay seem all the more loving and kind. So then we see what Ruth says. She has her own little speech in verses 15 to 18. So as we see Orpah walking away, we see Ruth clinging to Naomi. So that's quite a good word probably to describe her physical actions at that point. But it says much more as well. It describes Ruth's commitment to Naomi and everything she finds her identity in. So her country and her God, amongst other things. But where did it come from? We've seen that there was a close bond between Naomi and both of her daughters-in-law. But Orpah went back, so there was something more. And we can see that God must have been at work for this commitment to be there. Why else would Ruth's sort of decision be so different to Orpah's? We probably know from the story that God does bring blessing to Naomi in the end by providing her with a grandson who can continue the family line. This wouldn't have occurred if God hadn't caused Naomi to return in the first place and caused Ruth to cling to her, to go back with her. In Ruth's speech, she talks in a way that is evidence of God being at work in her life. She uses the covenant name of God, so Yahweh, when she says, "Your God will be my God," and is therefore probably aware of the covenant that God had with his people. So Ruth sees it as obedience to go back with Naomi and trust God to bless her for that obedience. So Ruth's commitment to Naomi and her country, her people and God is a further example of that hesed that we've been talking about, that kindness and all the other words. It might be that Ruth's faith was based on her knowledge of God's promise to bless those who are obedient. It might be the case that she knew about the Levirate law, which was what we see in action later with the kinsman redeemer. And she might have seen this as the way that God would bless them. But however much Ruth knew, she demonstrated here quite a commendable faith in God, which can be an example to us today. So the last section, we see the two of them arriving in Bethlehem, verses 19 to 22. I kind of get the picture that Naomi saw she'd lost the argument with Ruth due to her determination. It says in one translation that they carry on in silence, or a better translation means that she literally just ceased to speak. They didn't talk. She wasn't going to get through. So eventually they do come to Bethlehem, and we see that the town was stirred because of them. You might ask why. We're not given a lot of detail about Naomi and her family, but it might have been the case that as they left, they were the only family leaving, perhaps, or one of very few. So as they came back, the people would have remembered all those years ago, people leaving. It might be that they recognised an older lady coming back with a younger foreign woman, and they had heard about what had happened and that she was coming back with just this one daughter-in-law and all the things that had happened. So we see that the town was stirred, and then Naomi, having not said enough, speaks to the town there. She sees that they're stirred, and she comes with her second speech. She talks about her name change first, what it should be and why. She says she's changing her name to Mara, which means bitter. Because names had meaning then, Naomi believed that pleasant was no longer a fit description and that she was changing it to bitter. And Naomi's quick to realise that this bitterness has been from God. She says, "The Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me." And a question that I asked, that we might ask, is it right that at this point Naomi talks in this way about God? And there's different opinions. We need to see, to start with, that Naomi has been through so much. She's lost a husband and two sons. So perhaps things that we can't really imagine. And these things that she recognises as judgment from God, she probably didn't have a lot of say in. The husband probably decided that they were moving away in the first place. The sons probably decided they were going to get married. There was Naomi probably not having much say in it. So she has suffered because of other people's actions. So some would say that Naomi blaming God for all this is wrong, which would make this loving kindness, this hesed that God shows her, all the more powerful and undeserved. Others would say that her complaints show the sort of freedom that she felt she had in her faith, and that she has her actions are similar to Job or Jeremiah. Simon talked about Job, I think. The song we sang, "You Give and Take Away," is taken from there, and we see similar actions here. But throughout this speech, Ruth is completely ignored by Naomi. We can presume that she's probably stood somewhere close by, having just arrived in Bethlehem. Naomi forgets. The narrator doesn't forget about her, as sort of we have a summary sentence. We read that, "So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her." So here the writer highlights Ruth's foreignness, firstly, and he probably mentions her just to highlight the fact that Naomi hadn't in her second little bit of talk there. So although Naomi had complained that the Lord had brought back empty, Ruth probably stood there sort of as a living example that that's not actually true. She's not empty, she's come back with Ruth. And she stood there as a picture of the beginnings of God's blessings on Naomi and the source of all the kindness and love that she had received in the past 10 or so years. And then we see that the last sentence just links us to the next chapter. We see that the barley harvest was just beginning, and it reminds us that God has been in control from the start, and he'll continue to be. We saw that he was responsible for the famine to start with, but he's also responsible for bringing Naomi back with Ruth, and that she would be the source of the two of their survival and the survival of the whole family, as she brought food for them initially and then a son later on. So what can we get from this? How does it make a difference to us? It was written sort of 3,000, if not more, years ago. It happened then. I've picked up three things that we can take from this. We have seen that God is faithful to his promises. We talked about God's promises of blessing in the Old Testament, and I reminded us that we need to remember God promised that disobedience would be dealt with curse. Deuteronomy 28, verses 15 to 68 is a long and in-depth passage detailing the consequences of disobedience. So along with the kindness, or hesed, we see God showing in this passage in working in Naomi and Ruth's lives. We see God keeping his promises regarding disobedience too. Elimelech shouldn't have taken it into his own hands to go. The sons shouldn't have married Moabite women. And the death and the barrenness that we see is God keeping his promises there. And seeing this, we can be now sure that the new covenant promises that we have in the New Testament are also true. So things like John 3:16, carrying on to verse 18, says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have eternal life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned, but whoever does not believe stands condemned already, because they have not believed in the name of God's one and only true Son." So we need to recognize here that what God tells us through his word is real. It's trustworthy and it's true, and that we have promises of blessing and curse now. We need to ensure that as Christians, we are trusted in God completely, ensuring we don't fall into temptation and disobedience to God. We also need to see that there are those around us that do not believe, and that they're condemned until they do believe, as that verse just said. So we need to be obviously doing what we can to show them what we believe and giving them every opportunity to believe themselves. And what about the sort of everyday promises that we have in the New Testament? We have promises that God will answer our prayer. Matthew 7:7, "Ask and it will be given to you." I'm sure we've all seen answered prayer in our lives. As I said at the beginning, my family definitely has over the past few weeks. We also read about promises of persecutions that Christians will face. In John 15:20, Jesus says, "Remember what I told you. A servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they'll persecute you also." So, point number one, God keeps his promises. Secondly, we've seen that true faith in a true God, as exemplified in, well, in the bit of Nehemiah and Ruth, we need to ask ourselves at this point from this, where does our trust, loyalty and faithfulness lie? Is it fully in God, or is there other things that have some say in the way that we live our lives? Do we trust in our jobs to provide for our family? Do we trust in our families to provide us with happiness? Do we trust that what we can do for the church will somehow provide us with salvation? All these things, and many more I'm sure you can think of, are good things, but they're not things we should put our trust in. We need to learn from Ruth's example in the passage just read. To begin with, she was a foreigner. She was an outsider, someone who'd probably never heard about God and the blessing and his promises before. And we were all like that at one point too. But as Ruth committed herself to Naomi and her people, her God, and God worked in her life, we see that her trust and faith in God, and it's a trust and faith that we do really well to imitate. And as we do this, if we clearly display our faith and trust in our lives and exhibit God's chesed as Ruth did in this passage, it puts us in a really good place to be showing those people on the outside, those people who don't yet believe. It gives us a really good opportunity to be a witness and an example to them. We need to see that we face the same judgment as they did then, and that we need to put our trust in God to do that, and we need to show other people how to do that and how doing that gives us the best life possible, really. And that it doesn't really come in any other way. So lastly, sort of the title of tonight was God's always working, maybe not obviously, but he is. And it's a good passage to show that. And like I said at the start, it's a popular story, but we might not have actually noticed how much God is doing through this. Most of the chapter seems to portray tragedy and disaster, but as we look more closely, as we've done tonight, as we'll do the next few weeks, we see that God is at work. And although the story of Ruth develops and we see blessing for Naomi, it's not the biggest picture we'll see. If Ruth hadn't returned with Naomi, God's plan to bring Jesus into the world in the line of David wouldn't have been possible. I don't want to steal anyone else's sermon, so I'll stop there. We see that God's always working. Philippians 2:13 says, "For it's God who works in you to will and to act in order to fulfill his good purpose." So we should be thankful that God is working in our lives through his Holy Spirit and ensure that we don't prevent that by our own worldly perspectives, which might even seem the logical thing to do, like Naomi's argument for Ruth and Orpah to return did. And lastly, surely we can see God working in the world today, and usually in situations where we wouldn't expect it. So the church is growing all over the world, and we hear that persecution happens, but yet the church is still growing in those places. So hopefully from that we can be encouraged that God has been, he is, and he'll always be working for his good purpose. Amen.